Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Jim Bamford, who's the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets and The Puzzle Palace, which is written about the National Security Agency, previously known as No Such Agency. He is also the author of a new book, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agency. And we'll be talking to Jim Bamford, who knows more than most people about the inner workings of the National Security Agency, which, of course, is at the center of the legislation that was just passed in terms of enabling the National Security Agency to intercept calls related to foreign terrorists, but routed through the United States. And the Senate voted under pressure from the president, the president's way, and then the House, in the view of many, capitulated and voted for the president's bill, which of course was being pushed through as they all wanted, waiting to go on vacation. So we'll be looking into the technicalities of how this information is gathered and the extent to which the Bush administration has been in violation of the law and how much this legislation has enabled them to continue this secret regime. We'll then be joined by Lisa Graves, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for National Security Studies. Previously, she served as a Senior Counsel for Legislative Strategy at the American Civil Liberties Union, and she also was the Chief Nominations Counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee for ranking member Senator Patrick Leahy, of course, is now the Chair. And she also served in the Justice Department as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General and Acting Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Policy Development and the Office of Legal Policy. She also served as a Senior Counsel and Counsel in the Civil Rights and Civil Division, working on civil rights, the very part of the Justice Department that Attorney General Gonzalez has gutted. And then we'll talk with Dr. John Ackerman. He's in Mexico City. He is a professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National Autonomous University in Mexico City. We'll be talking to him about the very likely election today, Sunday, in the Mexican state of Baja California, bordering California, an area through which most of drugs enter the United States. And there's the extraordinary possibility that Jorge Henk Roan, the owner of Agua Caliente racetrack, the son of a famous corrupt dinosaur from the pre-party, with ties to crime and assassination, may well be elected governor of the state, which, of course, is this important corridor of contraband into the United States. I'm now speaking with Jim Bamford, who's the author of the bestsellers Body of Secrets and The Puzzle Palace. He's written extensively on national security issues, including investigative cover stories in the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post Magazine, and the Los Angeles Times Magazine. And he was formerly an investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, and his most recent book is A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agency. And last year, Jim won the National Magazine Award for Reporting. So what is what's really this secret program, as much as one can divine, has, well, first of all, we just learned in the last week that they're, in fact, not just the TSP, which is the one that's gotten all the attention and the reason why Gonzalez and Andy Card, at the behest of the vice president, went to the bedside of the Attorney General Ashcroft to try to get him to sign continuation of this or authorization of this TSP program. In defending Gonzalez, the Attorney General, from the possibility of perjuring himself, the Director of National Intelligence announced or revealed this week that there are several other equally top secret National Security Agency programs that were authorized in the wake of 9/11 by President Bush. So if you could, Jim Bamford, can you walk us through some of these programs, the ones that we know about and the ones that we've just been told about?
Well, yeah, it's hard to talk about things that the administration has kept so secret. There's only sort of bits and pieces that have made it to the surface so far. But basically, this hidden program at NSA involved a number of aspects. One of them, one of the ones that they were trying to keep very, very secret was turning NSA loose on domestic data mining. In other words, searching through millions of telephone records, who's calling whom, when, what time, emails, who's sending emails to whom, and you know, potentially even the contents of the emails. And then bypassing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a certainly a violation of federal law. It's a violation of the criminal statutes. Bypassing the FISA court in order to eavesdrop on potentially U.S. citizens on domestic phone calls, the phone calls that were international but where the U.S. person is in the United States. So there's a variety of these things, and you don't know where it begins or where it ends since the Congress hasn't been very successful in getting the administration to reveal what it is they're actually doing. The irony is that they were very quick in giving them permission to keep doing what they're doing without knowing what it is they're doing.
And that's what just took place over the weekend. And it's extraordinary that the Democrats capitulated. As you point out, they approved something that they don't really know what they're approving. What is the was it simply that the president was sort of buffaloing them and they all wanted to go on vacation?
Well, I think so. You know, the irony here is that you have all these congressmen that are jumping up and down screaming at the Iraqis, at the Iraqi parliament for taking a vacation and leaving all these huge issues on the table. And they're running for the suntan lotion and heading for the beach themselves while leaving a lot of things on the table, or even worse, rushing through very poor legislation without even knowing what it is they're rushing through. I mean, you would have thought they'd have learned their lesson after the first Patriot Act, when they rushed through that without reading it, when they rushed into the authorization to use force in Iraq without knowing what they were doing. And, you know, here they go again.
So How does this connect with the public humiliation of the Attorney General Gonzalez at his various appearances before the Senate Judiciary Committee and the House Judiciary Committee, where quite recently he's been accused of perjuring himself, and there's even been talk of impeaching him? Why do you, Jim Bamford, think that the Attorney General is falling on his sword? At least he appears to be falling on his sword to protect, presumably, the president or perhaps Karl Rove, and he's prepared to look like a fool in the front of the world. But I'm sure in private, the president says you're doing a hell of a job, Fredo.
Well, I think he's falling on a sword to protect not only the president but himself, because what you're witnessing there, when he's sitting there in front of the congressmen or the senators or the representatives, whatever, he's sitting there being questioned about illegal activities that he himself has been involved in. There's been two federal judges so far that have come out and said that the program is illegal, a district court judge and an appeals court judge. Both those judges are the only two judges that have ever ruled on the substance of the Bush program. The appeals court ended up rejecting the ACLU claim, but they rejected it, two of the judges on the appeals court anyway, two of the three, who were Bush appointees, rejected it not on the substance, but on the standing, whether or not the plaintiffs had a, you know, were could prove that they were eavesdropped on. So the two judges that did rule on it, on the substance, both ruled that the district court judge and one appeals court judge ruled that it was illegal. So what you have is the president and the attorney general both putting forward a program that federal judges have declared illegal. So, and this is a violation of a criminal statute. It's 10 years in prison. So that's what he's up there. He's up there defending himself and defending the president by saying as little as possible, or by covering up and saying it really wasn't part of the program and there really wasn't disagreement. I think he's up there trying to save his own hide and that of the president from criminal charges or potential impeachment.
And has the Director of National Intelligence opened a larger can of worms here by revealing that there are other programs in trying to get the Attorney General off the hook for a possible perjury by suggesting that the substance of the effort to get the bedside signature of the Attorney General, who was under anesthetic pre-op or post-op, but he was not in good shape. Is that what's going on here? I mean, have in fact they opened a worse can of worms?
Well, I think it'll continually be like that. The more the pressure gets put on Gonzalez and the White House, the more they're going to try to show that what they were doing was, if it wasn't necessarily legal, at least it was in order to try to protect the country. So I think that's what their emphasis is going to be in the future, is to try to claim that even though it probably violated the law, that we did it for good reasons. So I think they're going to selectively try to spin a little bit here and a little bit there by leaking various aspects of it to the press in order to spin it in their favor. So,
well, that
the problem
was, of course,
is once you start doing that, then other people who have been opposed to the program see that happening, and then they start leaking. So eventually you may have, at least by default, you may be able to get some of the information about what was going on in the program out despite Congress.
Well, of course, that was echoes the argument that was made in the Congress by the administration, which was that how could you go on vacation and leave America vulnerable to terrorists? Again, they were breaking the law for the longest time until somebody leaked to the New York Times that this program was underway. And cynically, the administration funneled enough stuff through the FISA court so that nobody would notice that their docket was drying up. It seems that what they've just passed is a promise to get in compliance with FISA later. I think wasn't there some kind of sunset on this bill that was just.
Well, I think they put a 6-month sunset on this. It gives the administration breathing room to come up with a proposal that they could get through Congress for either a permanent bill or else a bill with a longer sunset provision on it. So on this one they put a 6-month sunset, but that just to me doesn't make much sense. You either have the administration obey the law or not, or else not allow them to break the law. And here they're basically saying, well, we'll let you break the law for 6 months, and then during that period of time, we'll see if we can legalize the law breaking.
Well, obviously, there's a lot of suspicion because of the testimony of the Attorney General that he's covering for somebody and something. And in that vacuum, of course, you necessarily in the absence of information, a lot of conspiratorial ideas emerge, and one wonders given this secret ability, how it could be abused. We know it could be abused, and that's obviously what the Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect us from. And what's your sense on whether or not they have in fact been spying on American citizens, which is the very reason why we have a FISA court?
Well, in all the writing I do, I base it on what I know, not what I think may be possible in the realm of possibility. So I have no idea, and I wouldn't even want to speculate on, whether they're targeting oppositions or not, since there hasn't been a scintilla of evidence indicating that they are. My concern is less conspiratorial and more real. It's the fact that they have been violating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and as having written the only two books on NSA, I know what the power is of NSA. If NSA turned its full eavesdropping power domestically, and it's enormous. when the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was created in 1978, NSA had far less power back then. Yet, even then, they were very worried about NSA. But back then, all NSA could do basically was intercept, if they turned it domestically, intercept domestic landline telephones, telephones going to your office or your home, and that's about it. It couldn't read your mail. It couldn't do penetrate your FOPs or anything. But today, NSA basically could do that. They read, they could read your mail because most people's mail these days is sent electronically via email. They could, in essence, read your thoughts because people's thoughts are transmitted via cell phones and everything else as you're walking down the street, as you're driving your car, as you're virtually any thought you have is either going to be communicated over a cell phone or on an email. So the power NSA has today is tremendous, and yet we're doing away with the one protection, the only protection that the only wall between NSA and the public is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And if the government either tears it down, if the Congress lets them tear it down, or else the administration, you know, sneaks around it, that's an enormous violation of American civil liberties, because the NSA does have that enormous power.
But Jim Bamford, knowing as you do the people inside the National Security Agency, which is, I made the joke that it used to be referred to as no such agency. It was very, very secret. And I think, isn't it true that both the DNI and the DCI are both former NSA heads? But knowing that culture, if there were, if this program, this secret program, were being abused, and, for example, they were, you know, spying on American citizens or doing opposition research, would the people inside the bubble speak out?
I think in that case, there probably would have been more leaks. If somebody, if it was as blatant as that, where somebody was told to target communications in and out of Hillary Clinton's office or John Kerry or whatever during the last election, I think somebody would have leaked it somewhere to somebody. I mean, I still haven't been writing about NSA since my first book came out in 82, so for 25 years or so I've been writing about it. So I've developed a fair number of people inside NSA, and I think they would have, if they knew about it, they would have said something to me at some point. So it is possible. I mean, you've got the precedent of Watergate back in the early right. 70s and so forth, so anything's possible. It's just that I just haven't seen any evidence on it, so I can't.
Well, the NSA people then they're okay with FISA. They have no objection.
Yeah, the people that I deal with that I've talked to, you know, that I meet when I deal with NSA people for providing sources, that kind of thing. There's almost a universal feeling about with most of them that I talk to, and that is that they were very happy having FISA there because they know the trauma that they went through back in the mid-70s when the Church Committee was doing its investigation. NSA was looked upon, there was an actual criminal investigation by the Justice Department into NSA. Senior officials were read the Miranda rights. I mean, there was a potential that they were going to charge people at NSA with criminal activity since they were eavesdropping against the law on people. Eventually, the Justice Department decided not to prosecute. But it was a very traumatic time for NSA. And they basically changed their entire attitude. And they began appreciating the FISA Act that would keep them out of trouble. And so once it was revealed, and again, there were only a small section within NSA that really knew about this this program, but once it was revealed, then a lot of the people I talked to at NSA were very outraged at the administration because they'd spent the last 30 years rebuilding their reputation as one focused entirely on foreign communications. with a very, very small exception, and those small exceptions were approved by the FISA court, to now back to square one, back to where they were during the Church Committee hearings when the agency's being accused of illegality. So they're very angry that the senior leadership of NSA didn't either protest or resign rather than agree to the agree to do these operations that was asked of them by the White House and by Cheney's office and so forth.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Jim Bamford.
My pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Jim Bamford, who's the author of Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agency. He's also written extensively on the National Security Agency, his bestsellers, Body of Secrets and The Puzzle Palace. I'm now speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for National Security Studies. Previously, she served as a Senior Counsel for Legislative Strategy at the American Civil Liberties Union, and she led the U.S. ACLU's lobbying efforts on national security issues affecting civil liberties, including the Patriot Act and the illegal NSA wiretapping without warrants. Prior to that, she served as a Chief Nominations Counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee, ranking member, Senator Patrick Leahy, of course, is now in charge of the committee, and she was also served in the Justice Department as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General and Acting Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Policy Development and the Office of Legal Policy. She also served as a Senior Counsel and Counsel in the Civil Rights and Civil Division, working on civil rights and immigration issues, among other things. And of course, I understand, Lisa, that that's the very... Isn't that the very part of the Justice Department that essentially the Bush administration and Attorney General Gonzalez have gutted?
Well, I think that, in fact, that is the case, but I think it's pretty widespread across the department that the department as a whole has been politicized and the hiring processes at every level have been politicized by this administration. I came in through the Attorney General's Honor Program in a class that included a number of Republicans, a number of Democrats. There wasn't a party... line or litmus test, and we know from all the other reporting that there has been a political test imposed in all sorts of hiring at the department. And I think beyond that, there's just been a real politicization beyond the department of the intelligence community, seen most recently this week with the actions of the Director of National Intelligence and his lobbying and efforts on this new legislation that will unleash the NSA without warrants on all the international calls of Americans.
And in terms of, there's been speculation about the morale of the Justice Department in these many hearings. I just read a piece by Sidney Blumenthal who refers to the Omerta, the code of silence, has become the final bond holding the Bush administration together. Honesty is dishonorable. Silence is manly. Penitence is weakness. Loyalty trumps law. Protecting higher-ups is patriotism. Stonewalling is idealism. Telling the truth is informing. Cooperating with investigators is cowardice. Breaking the code is betrayal. And I know that maybe strong language, but it does indicate that many people in this country are appalled at the state of, or at least the perception of the Oval Office turning into a back room at an Italian restaurant, and the chief and law enforcement officer of the country appearing to fall on his sword like a good consigliere. What's your sense of why the Attorney General is allows himself to be so publicly humiliated? Is he, as it appears, covering up for somebody?
Well, you know, Sidney's analysis of these issues has been really excellent over the last several months. So I think that the situation over there is that the Attorney General has been an instrumental element of these decisions that have discredited our nation and basically harmed in a very severe way the rule of law here. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that he's covering up for anyone else. He's part of the core group that has made these decisions that have subverted the Constitution and that have violated federal statutes and our international agreements that have been ratified by the Senate. And I think that he won't resign because they don't want to have another confirmation situation with another attorney general and have that contingent upon the appointment of a special counsel to investigate all the wrongdoing of this administration, including the lawbreaking involved in the surveillance of Americans through what the president calls the terror surveillance program, but which we know has many tentacles beyond what's been described. And just this last week, in essence, was ratified by Congress in taking off the requirement that there be any warrant before the National Security Agency acquires all calls and emails going into or out of the United States, including domestic calls that they may think are international.
So why then would the loyal opposition in this country, in the face of this reckless and arrogant attitude towards the law exhibited by the administration and by its attorney general, be buffaloed into rolling over for them?
Well, I think a couple things are at work. I would say that, first, you have a situation in which the president's foreign policy has gone disastrously wrong and has created a situation in which nearly 6 years ago, in essence, Al-Qaeda was on the run. It was discredited. It was widely condemned. And now, due to an array of severe mistakes, it doesn't even seem to capture it. We have a deteriorating condition internationally and, in essence, a surge of Al-Qaeda, a growth in its recruitment, in part due to the wind that's been put in the sails of that recruitment by these the folly of the president's policy. And so you have a situation in which I think that the Democratic leaders of Congress are trying to deal in good faith on issues related to national security, despite the manifest bad faith of the administration. And they really were, I think, railroaded over this last several weeks. I think it's a decision that that will be regretted and that will, in fact, be undone, because this administration, I think, in a way that was incredibly regrettable for the credibility of the Intelligence Committee, which has already suffered greatly in the aftermath of Colin Powell's presentations to the United Nations about intelligence matters, now has been put in the position of trying to justify what the president has done. The president has said, to be clear, the president has claimed that they need this expanded power to target foreign terrorists abroad, and yet in the legislation the administration refused any effort to limit the power to terrorism. They refused any effort to limit the power to targeting suspected terrorists. They refused to limit the power to focusing on foreign communications abroad. And in fact, the legislation that the administration rammed through Congress would allow the NSA to acquire any electronic surveillance, to gather any electronic communications whenever there's one person abroad who they reasonably believe is abroad. So the exact language, so your listeners know, is whenever there is a person reasonably believed to be located abroad, then there's no warrant required. That person can be an American. That person can be a foreigner. That person can be talking to Americans. And so that applies to American tourists, Americans working abroad, Americans serving in the military, who call home. Those calls can be acquired without a warrant. And any calls between foreign companies or foreign individuals to the United States can be acquired without a warrant. So the president has gone to great pains to claim he only wants to know when Al-Qaeda is calling you. You know his famous line, if Al-Qaeda calls you, we want to know why. Now it's quite clear that the goal of the administration is if anyone calls you from outside the United States, we want to know why.
And Lisa Graves, what do you think, obviously the story about the bedside efforts to get the ailing Attorney General to sign off on authorizing this TSP program, which was witnessed by Comey and the director of the FBI, Mueller, Mueller, of course, recently contradicting Gonzalez about what that happened at that meeting. I understand that they were prepared. First of all, Comey was the one who told us about it. It was clearly something that was on his mind and eating at him. But wasn't it true that they were all prepared to resign? So unless this was brought into compliance with the law, so what do we know about what they found so objectionable that these men, who were pretty conservative, were prepared to resign over?
Well, Ian, that's a great question. You know, the situation is that that evening in the intensive care unit at the hospital, after there was apparently a meeting at the White House in which the Justice Department said there was not legal justification for the program, that the program did not have an adequate legal basis in all of its many tentacles. Nevertheless, the Attorney General and Andrew Card went to the ICU unit of Ashcroft to try to get him to override that decision, and the Attorney General has refused to say on whose behalf he went. He refused to say whether Cheney sent him or David Addington, Cheney's right-hand man, sent him, or whether the president himself sent him on this mission. But it is the case, and I certainly would believe Comey over Gonzalez in any test of credibility in these matters. I think Gonzalez has no credibility left in this town or as Attorney General. But if that is the case, and I believe it is, Americans should be extremely troubled by the extent of the policies of the administration, and we still don't have any adequate accounting of the extent of those programs. It appears from the most recent statements this past week that program, one of the facets of that program, included massive data mining of Americans, massive, on a massive scale. And we know from the Patriot Act debate that Congress gave the FBI a very specific power to use national security letters to acquire phone records that were, quote, relevant to an authorized investigation. But what this seems to reveal is that there was no requirement deployed by the administration to show any relevance or any connection at all between the records they sought and any specific investigation. And instead, they just decided to gather up wholesale communication records. And the administration's position, quite frankly, is you have no right to privacy in any records held about you by any company, and they're entitled to them. Every American should be disturbed by that philosophy of this administration.
Well, that, of course, is ironic that that flies in the face of true conservative values. And I guess you do have some people on the conservative side, like Ron Paul, who are coming out against this kind of abuse. But it does indicate a kind of radical nature of this regime in terms of its departure from conservative norms. But just in closing, Lisa Graves, isn't it the New York Times editorial recently said that it was Dick Cheney who sent Andrew Card and Gonzalez to that bedside, to Ashcroft's bedside?
Well, I would have no reason to doubt that, given his role. It certainly seems that the president has delegated perhaps one half of his presidency to the vice president, who claims that he's not even part of the executive office of the White House. He claims that he has some sort of fourth branch that he's in charge of, and he's not bound by any laws, the laws that govern either the executive branch or the legislative branch. And he, I believe, was instrumental in the manipulation of intelligence and closed-door briefings this past week that led to a situation on Thursday night in which the director of national intelligence agreed to support a Democratic alternative to the foreign intelligence legislation, said it would go a long way to help them increase their flexibility in targeting foreign terrorists. And then after that agreement was reached, the White House, I'm sure at the behest of Dick Cheney, said no, because they would rather have the political issue of further politicizing intelligence and national security, and because they wanted to have everything they wanted and have no limitations, not even an audit, to tell the Congress or the American people how American people's rights were going to be affected by increasing warrantless surveillance of international calls. So to be clear, the legislation that passed at the urging of the White House, and Cheney has that portfolio on these matters, would alter the law so that the president doesn't have to go to get a warrant for the acquisition of any electronic communications between any American and anyone abroad for any reason, untied to terrorism, unconnected to Al-Qaeda, without any independent check.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Lisa Graves, but I thank you so much for joining it. And I guess at the end of the day, it's up to the American people to decide whether or not this government is protecting them from terrorists or is, in fact, acting like Big Brother. And I thank you for lending your expertise to this.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Lisa Graves, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for National Security Studies. Let's now go to Mexico City. I'm speaking with Dr. John Ackerman, who is a professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National Autonomous University in Mexico City, where we are talking to him at the moment. He has been closely following, monitoring events and politics in Mexico. And today, Sunday, in Baja California, there's a very significant election where the mayor of Tijuana, Jorge Hank Rohn, is running on the pre-party, the original ruling party that ruled for over 70 years in Mexico, and there's a good chance that he will win. On the surface, John, this is pretty alarming given Jorge Hank Rohn's pedigree. He controls gambling in Baja California.
Uh-huh.
He owns Agua Caliente. His father, Jorge Hank Gonzalez, was the famous dinosaur who was a rural school teacher and ended up as a multi-billionaire because of his association with the pre-party, making the famous remark that a politician who is not rich is not a good politician.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been implicated in the assassination of Colosio, the pre-candidate who was killed in Tijuana. And he's also, his bodyguards were tried and convicted for shooting, killing the bodyguard of the independent journalist in Tijuana, who the editor and publisher of Zeta. He was badly wounded in the assassination attempt, yet somehow he's escaped from this. What would explain why Mexicans would vote for somebody with that kind of a pedigree?
Right. Ian, thank you very much for having me on your program again. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Yes, these elections today in Baja California are really quite symbolic, quite important in terms of what they mean in terms of the future and the present of Mexico's democracy. This is a phenomenon actually we've been seeing throughout Latin America. We have democratic transitions, we have different parties coming into power, but actually this new democratization of the access to power hasn't really changed the way in which government functions and the way in which the underlying social forces are organized. So even though we've had sort of formal democratization in Mexico, a different party coming to power, we're still witnessing that there's a basic continuity in the people who are calling the shots, the kind of economic and political powers that exist. And this is an example. I mean, we don't know yet whether Hank Rohn is going to actually win the governorship of Baja California. If he doesn't win, he will come very close to doing so. And that's a very good question. Why would people vote for this sort of politician? Well, he has sort of a populist image as being a man of the people. Ironically, of course, he's not at all the people. He's one of the wealthiest people in Mexico, and as you mentioned, owns these betting and gambling establishments throughout the state and throughout the country. And his family has been in politics and wealthy for a long time. But he has this kind of populist attraction, and this is just an example of sort of the failure of democracy and in Mexico over the last 2 years to actually respond to the needs of the vast amount of poor people in Mexico. Mexico is still a very poor country, and people are looking for someone who can try to save them and change politics. And he has this, ironically, of course, again, but he has this idea that, or at least a discourse, that he's going to change things. Now, if he were to win, and even if he doesn't, the strong showing he's having is exactly the suspicion, of course, as you are playing out with his biography, is that there is some link to narco trafficking in Mexico. We all know this is a major problem. In 2007 alone, over 1,000 people have been assassinated based on narco-related violence. This includes police, military, citizens, innocent citizens. But in general, there's a real crisis in Mexico today. And today goes back decades, but it's gotten worse, really, in the last 6 or 7 years. And this is a demonstration that actually, with the arrival of a new party in power, the PAN on the executive level, from 2000 to now, actually things have gotten worse. The violence and related violence has gotten to really created a crisis in Mexico.
And the new PAN president has made a war on drugs, if you will, the centerpiece. And so, first of all, I know you wrote about it recently in The Guardian, Dr. John Ackerman, but let's talk about whether or not it's appropriate to have a war. I mean, we have a war on drugs here, and it's become metastasized and dysfunctional. And in many ways, the Mexicans say, you know, unless you and America don't deal with the demand side, there's nothing we can do about the supply side, because there are always going to be somebody that'll be attracted to the market. So, Calderon's making this a priority? Is it indeed a dagger at the heart of Mexican democracy?
Yes, Calderon has made this his number one priority in his first 8 or 9 months in power. The issue here is that he's really taken more sort of publicity, public relations strategies, and less of a real deep strategy of attacking the problem of narco trafficking at its roots. He has not set out a clear strategy of breaking with, for instance, the Fox administration or the previous pre-administrations. We do have this discovery in March of $205 million in a room in a man's house here in Mexico, Chen Yigong, who is now in jail actually in the United States. They found the money, but they didn't find him. He had actually escaped beforehand around November last year to the U.S. The U.S. has now grabbed him, but the Mexican government was clearly inefficacious in actually getting him. And all these, this great use of the military in this generalized supposed war on drugs, there hasn't been any real top-line narco-trafficker who has been brought to jail or even had significant charges brought against him. The suspicion is that this is really just a strategy to build up legitimacy after the 2006 elections, as we all know, were very, very much questioned, and Calderon came in sort of similar to Bush in 2000 with a very low legitimacy score, and that he sort of fabricated this war in order to boost up his legitimacy. Now, of course, narco traffic in Mexico is different from perhaps this more abstract terrorist threat in the United States, and so maybe it does justify stronger actions, but like I said, the actions he's actually bringing upon, taking on Calderon, are not getting to the source. They're not based on investigation. They're not based on actually grabbing these narco traffickers and putting them in jail. It's more of a public relations stunt, yeah.
And I believe the just as we have a problem here in the United States over executive overreach in terms of spying in the name of the war on terror, you know, this Congress just enabled the Bush administration to continue spying without the oversight of the FISA court, an extraordinary capitulation on the part of the Democrats. But nevertheless, it's all being done in the name of terrorism. Now, how much are Mexico's civil liberties being eroded in the name of fighting the narcos?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Ian. Really, here in Mexico, we have very similar developments in terms of the attack on civil liberties as in the United States. And in fact, it's a little bit worse. Calderon has proposed to Congress, for instance, to change the Constitution itself. Bush, I don't think, would ever dare to try to change our constitutional right to against unreasonable search and seizures, right? But here in Mexico, Calderon has proposed to change the Constitution to actually strike out part of our constitutional article which says that, and allow the Attorney General to, on his own, listen in on conversations and do searches of houses, etc., basically without any judicial review. He's also just received, the Mexican government has just received a $4 million apparatus from the U.S. government that will allow the Mexican government to listen in to telephone conversations in a broad, indiscriminate way, including, of course, Mexicans who live in the United States. I mean, anybody who's talking to a Mexican might be intervening in this system. And so Calderon has really taken on this war on drugs and war on terror. It's linked to the war on terror in Mexico as well, of course. Calderon has also passed a new law which allows anybody who tries to pressure the government to take a particular decision using questionable means, who knows what questionable means, to be categorized as a terrorist, for instance. Terrorism is suddenly starting to take a broader, sort of more abstract meaning in Mexico. So all these are very parallel developments to what's happening in the United States. And I really think it's important for people on both sides of the border to be aware that there are parallel developments, to try to organize some sort of collective consciousness about the matter. Yeah.
And the Chinese businessman you mentioned earlier, who was found with $205 million in his home in a wealthy suburb of Mexico City, he owned and operated a pharmaceutical company that apparently was making methamphetamine that was being exported here to the United States illegally. So his defense was that this was a payoff to the PAN. Now, was he being mischievous? Or because I understand that the real problem, going back to Jorge Hank Rohn getting elected as a priester in Baja, is that there's been long-standing associations of this largely discredited pre-party and the narco traffickers. So is it possible that the influence of the narco traffickers is ubiquitous?
Yeah, well, this is really an important case in that way. Sandy Yeguang is a Chinese businessman who's nationalized Mexican. He's a Mexican citizen. Yes, he's $205 million. He claimed they were linked to the PAN campaign. Actually, what he has claimed is that if López Obrador were to win last year, this money was supposed to be used to destabilize the country, buy arms and this kind of stuff, to make sure that you wouldn't be able to actually take up the presidency. Now, whether that specific declaration is correct or not, I don't know, but that this money definitely exists because of close complicity between the government and he and other narco traffickers is very clear. No one's going to have $205 million bills, $100 bills in his house if he doesn't have clear protection from the authorities. It's been coming out recently that many of the authorizations to import precursors to methamphetamine that he was developing and then producing and then selling to the United States, many of those authorizations were false or had been concocted by officials within the Fox government. And so really what we see here is that there is a clear link between drug trafficking and the sitting government, and that there hasn't been either Fox nor Calderon a real break with this tradition in the past of the PRI to link up the public power, the political power, with these more informal powers like the drug trafficking. So the concern is still very much there, and we really need to be aware of what's going on, yeah.
So if you have for example, we're talking about Baja, where there's a fellow with a very shady past and a shady pedigree, likely to get elected as governor of the state through which most of the drugs enter the United States. You've got a constant mayhem going on in the state of Guerrero, particularly in Acapulco, where narcos dressed as police recently just went into a police station and machine gunned everybody, including the secretaries. So it's, you know, and there's always been the suspicion that the Figueroa family, the PRI family that ran Guerrero forever, were in bed with the narcos. I'm just wondering whether there is, if all of the parties are tainted, then that's one matter. But if the PRI is really the most tainted, is it possible that with narco money and influence that they are trying to destabilize the country in order to essentially get elected, create the mayhem and then come in and be the saviors, you know, that old dark tactic.
Right, creating the problem and then coming in as the one who's saving the, who's solving the problem. That definitely could be the case. This would not be a crazy thesis. This could definitely be the case. It would be wrong, I think, to think that the Calderon government or the Pan government has somehow made a clear break with that previous tradition, as I was mentioning. It's not so much a question of pre versus Pan as it is sectors of both, I guess, who are trying to still defend their power and authority that they have in government. Yes, but there is definitely that risk, because there are some very important elements within the PRI, and I guess within the PAN as well, who are linked up to this narco-trafficking. And without better control over the flow of money, for instance, in campaigns, these guys could definitely be leveraging those kinds of contacts to try to come back into power. And this is a great example, or not so great example, but a clear example, yeah.
So the United States is already bogged down and essentially getting nowhere in Colombia, making an enormous military and financial investment there in the war on drugs, and in particular in a leader, Uribe, that's in many ways like Calderon. He came in on the same kind of ticket and the same kind of promises. And it seems to me that the notion that the United States could end up with a Colombia on its border should make people in Washington pay attention.
Yeah.
But I get the impression there's not much that we'll ever do about this problem in the United States as long as we have this dysfunctional war on drugs where it's just become a kind of make work bureaucracy, the DEA, the statistics indicate that the war on drug we continually lose, but on the other hand, we've created a kind of empire, symbiotic empire based upon this problem, and nobody, just like with healthcare, nobody wants to bite the bullet and recognize that the insurance people shouldn't be in the healthcare business, and accept the inevitability and logic of single payer. It would seem to me that equally true that unless somebody has the courage to sort of say the emperor has no clothes in terms of the war on drug, and medicalize the problem, not legalize, which is the canard, but medicalize the problem, and take this underground economy away from criminals, we're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And the solution is definitely within the demand side in the United States. Both reducing demand and perhaps exploring solutions of channeling supply through more legal ways, because yes, this is creating the United States. You already see the results in terms of urban violence, but as we see in Mexico, this is just creating a huge situation, a political crisis, and economic instability and social problems. And there's only so much that Calderon or any government could do to actually try to stop this chaos, which is being produced in Mexico through this massive drug trade. Really, the way to do it is exactly to bite the bullet and to think about more creative legalizing solutions, definitely.
Well, just in the last minute, changing the subject a little, you know that immigration is a huge issue here in the United States, and it was essentially forever it's been swept under the rug politically. It's been obviously been an economic reality and been driven by economics. And now that people are actually trying to essentially coming out of the shadows, it seems the American people don't want to face up to the complexity of the situation. I get the impression that we have got it totally backwards here in this country, and I wonder what it's like from the Mexican point of view. And that is that, to me, the answer to this is to make it easier to cross the border, not harder. That if you were able to allow people to come and go and visit families and have proper visas and proper identification, then you would end up with a situation where a lot of people wouldn't feel trapped in this country. I mean, what's the reading on the other side of the border? I know that there's a joke in Mexico that Fox promised 10 million new jobs, and the problem was they all ended up in America.
Right, yeah. The real solution to the immigration issue is economic development in Mexico. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Mexicans go to Los Angeles, California, and states, principally in search of economic opportunities, occupy jobs that other Americans wouldn't necessarily take and that are available for Mexicans to work in the United States economy. So obviously, a punitive strategy or criminalization strategy is not the idea. It's just attending sort of with a drug issue as well, attending to the symptoms and not the causes. The cause is economic development in Mexico. So really what should be thought about is a serious support by by U.S. Government and U.S. businesses as well to develop the Mexican countryside, develop Mexican infrastructure, Mexican investment. This is really one continent, at least North America, if you want to include all of Latin America, but at least Mexico, the United States, and Canada are really one economy. And if the Mexican side is suffering, we're growing at about 2 or 3%, but that's not enough for the population growth. If the Mexican economy continues to suffer, we're all going to suffer. And migration, you're right, should be a natural part of this. Open borders would be a good solution, and it would be a particularly good solution if the Mexican economy were thriving, because if the Mexican economy is not thriving, then people will just come over and we'll have the same problem of lack of jobs in the United States as we have in Mexico. So it really needs to be a strategy, a joint strategy of yes, opening the borders, allowing people to travel back and forth, but also really strengthening and investing in the Mexican economy.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. John Ackerman.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure as always to be with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. John Ackerman, who's a professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National Autonomous University in Mexico City. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, and Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, Lick Doan, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.